I'm Tom Glisserman, and this is number 0581, the Stuff File Program, with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File Program, number 0581. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File Program, Dr. Dan Calla is back to talk about his latest medical thriller, The Last High.
I've written about many medical topics, but never have I written about one that's closer to the home. It's a story about the opioid crisis in Vancouver, but Vancouver really could be any city. I mean, Vancouver's been hit terribly hard, but just a reflection of how bad the opioid crisis has gotten, the epidemic, and, you know, and how many lives it's affecting directly and indirectly, and really the mass death that's involved in it. And so I wanted to capture all this in kind of a cautionary tale.
Travel expert Pete Trabucco on how and when travel can get back to normal in a post-COVID world.
Right now, things are a little iffy with the amusement park industry and travel. We still have a situation when it comes to the COVID-19 issues. We've lost a bunch of furloughed people in the airlines, and of course, Disneyland and Disney World have followed suit. So there's a little bit of a slide back. However, people are still going to parks. People are still flying. Life will continue to go on. People will continue to go to amusement parks. It just won't be on the same level as it was until a vaccine is put together, whenever that might be.
And science writer Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy, is back to talk about gas on Venus and also how we miss not one, but two asteroids coming our way.
Sometimes, like in these two occasions in August and September, the asteroids appear to be coming from in the direction from the sun, from our vantage point. So when they're coming, it's sort of in the area of the sky where the sun is. Of course, we're blinded by the sunlight. And so we cannot see an asteroid or any object coming from that direction. And that was the case with these two. So that is a factor also in our inability to catch these things until they're almost upon us.
And there's lots and lots of Stuff File news and, of course, an idiot of the day. The guest later, the person who told you this was show number 0581, was Tom Glisserman, who is a director and visual storyteller. He's also someone I went to college with back in the day at Dawson College. Thank you very much, Tom, for doing the guest slate of this edition of the Stuff File Program, a show that is listener-supported, fan-funded radio that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Well, here's a story that is literally ripped from the headlines, and trust me, it is not an allegory for anything. Voters in the village of Defaselu, Romania, re-elected popular mayor Ion Aleman to a third term in a landslide victory on September 27th, despite the fact that he had died of COVID-19 10 days before the election. The Associated Press reported that word of the mayor's passing had spread fast among the village's 3,000 residents, but his name still appeared on the ballots, and many villagers used the vote as an opportunity to honor Aleman, who would have celebrated his 57th birthday on Election Day. After the results were revealed, many villagers went to his grave to pay respects and light candles, saying, "We will make you proud, and this is your victory." Considering where they're talking to him, is it really his victory, though? And while there, would it have been in bad taste to break out into singing Happy Birthday? Meanwhile, how much therapy do you think his opponent will need? "I lost in a landslide to a dead guy. Kill me. Kill me now." After throwing a Bible that struck a Marion County, Florida sheriff's deputy in the face, 39-year-old Robert Otis Hoskins of Summerfield told officers that God had directed him to break into his neighbor's home and free their young daughter. Police were responding to reports of a burglary on September 22nd when they encountered Hoskins, who emerged from the house next door wearing nothing but briefs and yelling something like, "I condemn you," before throwing the Bible. Officers tased him and took him into custody. Hoskins' wife told deputies he does have a drug problem. The alleged victim said about $50 worth of clothing had been stolen, and Hoskins was booked on multiple charges. Well, hitting a cop in the face with a Bible, was one of those charges Bible thumping? I want to be there when he's sworn in for his court proceeding. See what he does with the Bible then. A high court judge in Liverpool, England, has rejected Cheryl Pyle's attempt to sue the Liverpool police for violating her rights in April of 2017 when four female officers changed her out of the clothes she had vomited in. Calling the officers' actions an act of decency, the judge noted that Pyle, who later paid a fine for being drunk and disorderly, was too insensible with drink to have much idea of either where she was or what she was doing there, and would otherwise have been left, quote, to marinate overnight in her own bodily fluids, unquote. Yes, that's right. Somewhere in official court transcripts in Liverpool, you can see the sentence, marinate overnight in her own bodily fluids. Yeah. Five parrots at a UK wildlife park have been removed from public display after they started swearing at visitors. The African grey parrots were adopted by the Lincolnshire Wildlife Park in August and placed in quarantine together. However, after being moved into the main outdoor aviaries, the birds started ruffling a few feathers with their somewhat choice language. They have now been moved into different colonies away from delicate ears. Jess Newton said, "It was very entertaining working with the birds when they first arrived." However, she said it was hoped they would kick the habit when they were put outside. According to the park chief executive, Steve Nichols, sadly, this did not quite go to plan. The parrots swear to trigger reaction or a response, so if people look shocked or laugh, it just encourages them to do more. Wow. Sounds like a politician I know. Nichols went on to say, with the five, one would swear and another would laugh, and that would carry on. Some visitors found it funny, but with kids visiting at weekends, we decided to move them. I'm hoping they learn different words within colonies. But if they teach the others bad language, and I end up with 250 swearing birds, I don't know what we'll do. Well, you can name them all Polly and give them crackers. That seems to have worked in the past. It does all seem ironic, though, doesn't it? I mean, you know, a flock of birds with foul language. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest here on this edition of the Stuff Fall program, shall we? Back in April, we spoke with Dr. Dan Calla, who is not only a real-life ER doctor in BC, but an amazing medical thriller writer. At the time, we spoke about his day job and how he was dealing with the current pandemic, but I promised to have him back on the show to talk about his latest novel, which is called The Last High. It came out in May. Well, that time is now, so once again, Dr. Dan joins us via Skype from British Columbia. Hi, Dan.
Hey, Peter. Great to be back with you.
Great to have you on the program once again. Now, when we talked back earlier in April when we discussed the pandemic, we also discussed the fact that it must be difficult for someone like yourself, day in, day out, having to deal with the pandemic and then going home and I guess decompressing from all of that. Here is another situation where there's a bit of a pandemic, especially on the West Coast with opioids, and instead of decompressing, you go home and write about it.
That's a form of decompressing.
Okay. Tell us about The Last High.
Yeah, well, the Last High really is, you know, I've written about many medical topics, but never have I written about one that's closer to the home. you know, it's a story about the opioid crisis in Vancouver, but Vancouver really could be any city. I mean, Vancouver's been hit terribly hard, as you know, but just a reflection of how bad the opioid crisis has gotten, the epidemic, as you called it, basically, and, you know, and how many lives it's affecting directly and indirectly, and really the mass death that's involved in it. And so I wanted to capture all this in kind of a cautionary tale. I have two daughters who are, you know, 19 and 22, and especially for that generation, I didn't want to just lecture at them. I wanted to show them with a story that's sort of an ultra-realistic thriller about a really bad batch of fentanyl that's killing people in even higher rate than normal fentanyl, which, you know, because there's no quality control in the drug world and drug production world, it's entirely possible to happen. And the race to stop this drug is many people, from hardened addicts to first-time users to people who don't even realize they're using it, all start dying from this drug.
Besides your day-to-day life in dealing with this as a physician, what kind of research did you have to dig deep into to be able to write this book?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I know the medical side cold. I've been working in an inner city, hospital of St. Paul's in Vancouver, which is the epicenter of the drug crisis. So I know, you know, I've seen way too many opioid overdoses and deaths and all the tragedy related. I understood that side. What I didn't know anything about was the criminal element, how this drug gets in the country, how it's distributed, the trafficking, the dealing. And fortunately, I played hockey with a very colorful undercover cop who works in the general drug trade. I can't even be more specific than that, but he's done it for 15 or 20 years, and he was an unbelievable resource. He gave me a crash course in the Vancouver underworld, which I had no idea the extent of it, all the various gangs and ethnicities and how the trade works and how cavalier and callous and how stupid so many of them are. And it was just fascinating. And to me, that brought this novel to life, is more than the medical side. It's the criminal side and showing, you know, there's really no one single villain in this book, but a collection of them who, through, you know, just malignant greed and idiocy and just, you know, a disregard for human life create this crisis. And I think that's a very accurate reflection of the current drug world that we have in this city.
As you say, this is the first time you've done a story like this that is more close to home and more closer to what you do on a regular basis. Having said that, are you concerned at all or worried at all that since you, again, have dealt with a lot of opioid death in your day-to-day life, that somehow somebody might say you're making light of the situation?
Oh, no, I don't think anybody who reads this story would see it as light. I mean, I think there's light moments and there's, you know, suspenseful moments and thrillers. I think there's a ton of tragedy captured in this story that's a reflection of, you know, I'm proud of, you know, I think if you read the reviews of people who've read it and stuff, I think people realize the messages I was trying to get out. I was trying to give people a front row seat to this crisis and show them, you know, just the incredible collateral damage that's associated with the opioid crisis. And so I'm not worried about that. I think, you know, if anything, you know, there's kids who die in it. There's, if anything, there's a heaviness that I worry about. But I think it's balanced enough with a thriller aspect that most people have seemed to enjoy it, or at least powered through reading the novel.
Well, you say the message you want to get out there. You've written a lot of thrillers. Is this one of the first ones that is more personal to you? Did you want to have a message with your previous thrillers, or just fun escapist reading as far as those were concerned, which they were, by the way?
Yeah, my pandemic stories are just like romps through the park. And, no, I mean, like, and the message was a warning message about what could happen with pandemics and, you know, super bugs and other things that I've tackled. But this message is more personal and more specific for me. This is it could happen to you. It could happen to your loved one. It could happen to your friend's kids. It's out there, and no one is immune. This touches almost everyone. And, you know, it's so easy to go down this road, you know, with either choosing to doing kind of these kind of heavy drugs, or, you know, like opioids, or even inadvertently by doing other drugs and not even realizing you're getting contamination. Like, so much of the cocaine we see is contaminated with fentanyl. And so, you know, definitely this one has a more specific message. But no, the others were all meant to... my goal always is to educate and entertain at the same time. But this one I'm really hoping hits home with, especially, you know, that generation of teens and 20-somethings who are sort of the highest risk. I mean, the sad truth is most people who die of opioids are under 35 years old. And so, I very much targeted them in my message.
In some of your previous books, you had a few returning characters. In this one, you have Dr. Julie Reese and also Detective Anson Chen. As you were writing these, did you think, maybe perhaps I have another story or two within these characters in future books?
Not really. I mean, I wouldn't rule that out, but, I've already, the next novel is written, is coming out. It's a whole new set of characters. You and I have talked about this before. I don't repeat characters very often in novels. I like the fresh slate thing. I don't like trying to remember who's dead and who's gay and who's got kids and who doesn't. It's just easier to keep the characters straight when you contain them in one novel. But I mean, I like these characters. I would be very happy to revisit them in the future, but I don't have any specific plans to.
Even though the main protagonist in your book is a different gender than yours, when somebody reads your books, do they ever see you in the characters? People who know you?
Yeah, I mean, she's the lead character. So Julie is this fentanyl using, is a recovered addict. Like she is an opioid addict herself. She had fallen, her and her boyfriend in med school had fallen into addiction. And it had killed her fiance and almost killed her and certainly almost destroyed her career. So this whole thing, and now she's an emergency doctor, which obviously parallels me, and she's also a toxicologist, a poisoning specialist, and that's why she gets involved with the police. But, so she certainly has a dark past and has, the story is personal to her, but which none of those are true of me. I certainly have my issues, but opioid addiction has never been one of them. But also, she also has the kind of bravery and, conscientiousness and principledness that's probably a bit beyond me. So I don't really see myself in her. More in terms of some of the people I work with and stuff. I admire her, but no, I don't see myself in her. Although, Peter, I got to tell you the one line in the book that everybody talks to me about, and to give it away as a spoiler, is that at one point she's telling Anson, her detective friend, about what emergency doctors are like and how so many of them have sidelight careers, like I do personally. She's saying there's somebody who does real estate, and she goes, and then she says there's even somebody who writes medical thrillers in my department, and they're not half bad. And the number of people I've gotten who have written me about that line. So that's the closest self-referential thing I have in the book.
Well, I think Julie is underselling the situation, but that's just my point. we talked about the pandemic a while back, and at some point, fingers crossed, this will all end. Mm-hmm. But the opioid pandemic, you see this day in and day out. You've now written about it. Do you see an end to this?
It's hard to see one, Peter. And as I think we talked about, but it's happened, the opioid crisis has gotten much worse in Vancouver since COVID. There's been a disruption of the drug supply, which has made it more unstable and less consistent, which is exactly what I wrote about in the last high. Opioid users themselves are afraid of using to a degree with other people, so they're tending to use more alone, which is a huge recipe. That's how opioid users die, when they use alone and there's no one there to give them the antidote or call 911 or whatever. So, if you take August alone, it was a record high death rate in Vancouver, something 170 some opioid deaths, most of whom, as I said, were under 40. Like in all of COVID, we have 200 some deaths. So in 1 month alone, and their average age would be mid-80s, right? So in 1 month alone, the opioid crisis almost equaled what happened with the COVID crisis in terms of death here. And it just goes on and on year after year. I mean, public health interventions in BC have made somewhat of a difference. We've probably cut the death rate down by 40 or 50%, but it's still way too high, and it's going to take massive intervention. And I don't know if you want to get into this, but I really believe that eventually we have to legalize opioids and then control the supply. And that's the only way to stop people from dying en masse from this.
Wow. Interesting topic indeed, and it always I always find it interesting that again, you start writing a book and you don't know how topical it's going to be by the time you finish. But I mean, even your previous books still today are extremely topical and extremely present. And The Last High is certainly one of those, and I'm sure it's going to be an amazingly huge success. I thank you once again for being on the program with us, Dan. Always a pleasure to have you on the show to talk about your work.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter. One of my favorite shows to be on.
Dr. Dan Calla. His new book is called The Last High. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the page number for this show, which is show number 0581, and you'll find links to Dan's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his new book directly. And again, if you're looking for some great reads, I cannot stress enough the enjoyment in reading some of his earlier medical thrillers, such as the three titles I mentioned before. Once again, they are Pandemic, there's Resistance, and there's Cold Plague. All of them are the true definition of page-turners. Check them out. Also, I'm sure you noticed Dr. Dan dropped a shoe when, right at the end of our conversation, he mentioned legalizing opioids. Well, we couldn't just leave that hanging, so Patreon subscribers to the Stuff File program, you can hear Dan's thoughts about the legalization of opioids as a Patreon rewards extra. Just go to our Patreon page, and if you're not already a member, become one of the select patrons of the show. Visit patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. You're listening to The Stuff File Program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
The Stuff File Program is a listener-supported, fan-funded radio show that depends on you for our success. Join us at patreon.com to help make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. Sign up and find out about our rewards program. Being a patron doesn't have to be a long-term commitment. There's absolutely no obligation. You could join today and end whenever you'd like. But the time we have your support would be so greatly appreciated. We'd also love to hear your thoughts about the show and even your ideas for rewards. Join us for the ride. Join us at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram. This is The Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder. This broadcast is coming to you from upstairs. Get out of the house.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk about travel in the pandemic world. And Andrew Mazakis, the night sky guy, is back to atone for why he didn't tell us that asteroids were heading our way. And we also have an idiot of the day coming your way a little later on, and much more Stuff File news here on the Stuff File program, which is heard everywhere, including on Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, just to name a few. It's also heard on several radio stations, including WLSL-LPFM in Dade City, Florida, CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg, and CKLU 96.7 FM in Sudbury, just to name a few. Thanks to all for joining in. Anyway, let's get back to the stuff, shall we? Police in Vietnam have confiscated an estimated 345,000 used condoms, yes, you heard right, which had been cleaned and resold as new. Footage by state-owned Vietnam television showed dozens of large bags containing the used contraceptives scattered across the floor of a warehouse. Police said the bags weighed almost 800 pounds, equivalent to around 345,000 condoms. The owner of the warehouse said they had received a monthly input of used condoms from an unknown person. A woman detained during the operation told police the used condoms were first boiled in water, then dried and reshaped on a wooden phallus before being repackaged and resold. It's not clear how many of the recycled condoms had already been sold. The detained woman said she had received 17 cents for every kilogram of recycled condoms she produced. Wow. I bet all of you have exactly the same question in your head that I have in mine. How do they collect these things? I mean, it's not exactly like refunding a soda can or bottle. Who gets this extremely icky job, and who is the twisted mastermind who dreamed up this idea? I have a great idea for the company name, but I can't say it here on the show. It's the exact same refrain I had when I first heard this story. So let's just move on. The Cherokee County, Georgia Sheriff's Office posted a congratulations on Facebook to 33-year-old Sean Jones for winning the state lottery. How did they know? A deputy had pulled over a car for a minor violation, but a passenger, who they identified as Jones, jumped out and ran away, allegedly dropping a backpack. Inside the backpack, they say, was a laptop, some meth, and a $100 winning scratch-off ticket. Jones was found nearby and arrested, charged with obstruction and drug possession. Yes, he will get his lottery ticket back, a sheriff spokesperson said, but we are keeping his methamphetamine. Oh, it's his lucky day, isn't it? But anything you drop can and will be used against you in a court of law. And we've got a couple of stories dealing with some folks who haven't quite let go of outdated technology. And full disclosure, I know it might be hypocritical to say that when I still have a flip phone and a fax machine, but I digress. First up, Taro Kono, Japan's new Minister for Administrative Reform, is wasting no time in starting his crusade to cut down on bureaucratic red tape. And among his first targets is the fax machine, which is still in use in more than 95% of businesses in Japan. Said Kono, "I don't think there are many administrative procedures that actually need printing out paper and faxing." A day after being appointed to his new job, Kono created a red tape hotline on his website, inviting public input that had to be shut down the next day after receiving more than 4,000 responses. Well, he probably would have gotten more if he had given out a fax number. Meanwhile, 46-year-old Keith Bibonis knows a secret about the Chicago Police Department. They still use typewriters. Bibonis knows this because he repairs them when officers abuse them. "Police officers in general are very heavy typists," said Bibonis, who carries on the business his dad started in the late 1960s. That would be Bibone Office Machines and Supplies. He contracts every year to repair 40 to 50 IBM Wheelwriters. That's early word processing machines that can store a few pages worth of data. "I don't want to seem like I'm saying they're taking their frustrations out on the typewriter," Bibonis said, "but they're just not very sensitive with these machines." Yeah, there's nothing worse than an angry, ham-fisted cop at a typewriter. They're just lucky that they're using IBM Wheelwriters, as far as I'm concerned. Could you imagine how much damage they could do on an older manual typewriter? With an overly violent carriage return, they could wipe out any person who might be to their left, especially if their family jewels were a little higher than desk high. You know what I mean. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here in this edition of the Stuff All program, shall we? It was back in April when we last had travel expert Pete Trabucco on the show to talk about how and when travel and amusement park visits will return in a post-pandemic world. Well, here we are 6 months later, so I thought it would be a good time to touch base with Pete to see where travel stands. Pete is the author of A Personal Guide to the Best Amusement Parks and Water Parks. He joins us via Skype from New Jersey. Hi, Pete.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks very much for being on the program with us once again. So, right now, in the midst of all the news we've been hearing, airlines are cutting back, Disney is laying off people. It seems like the people or the places where one would go when it comes to travel are really hurting. But do you see an end in sight?
Well, I'll tell you, right now things are a little iffy with the amusement park industry and travel. Unfortunately, as it is, the United States, I'm not sure too well in Canada, but in the United States right now, we still have a situation when it comes to the COVID-19 issues. As you know, we've lost a bunch of furloughed people in the airlines, and of course, Disneyland and Disney World have followed suit. So there's a little bit of a slide back at this point. However, people are still going to the parks. People are still flying. people are still doing business as usual. They're just doing it in a different way. Usually they'll do it through what we're doing through Skype or actually doing things through at home and so on down the line. Life will continue to go on. People will continue to go to amusement parks. It just won't be on the same level as it was until a vaccine is put together, whenever that might be.
Well, let me ask you, you're the travel expert. Since I last spoke to you 6 months ago, have you been anywhere? And if so, can you tell us what differences you've noticed or what precautions you've noticed in any of the travels you've done?
Well, I've gone flying a few times. I've also gone to several amusement parks, Six Flags, as well as Disney, and so on down the line. I will tell you that at the amusement parks, it actually, in a way, is kind of good in that there is not as many people. You can get on rides a little quicker. And of course, you've got to be able to fend for yourself. A lot of places that normally would be open for food don't stay open as long. And of course, you have to wear a mask, which is kind of uncomfortable, but at the same time, you can get through it. Overall, the lines are shorter, although it appears to be longer because of the fact that there's 6 foot distancing at the parks. Now, if you're on an airplane, you can really skate right through a lot of the TSA areas. And on the airplanes, they're really not full at this point. Usually, the airlines are losing a lot of money because of the fact that they need to have 98% of all these airplanes filled in order to even break even on board a lot of these aircraft. And that's not happening. So that's one of the reasons why a lot of the airlines are having issues at this point. And of course, they're going to need some help from the federal government in order to continue to survive. So things are definitely different. It's kind of like a ghost town when you go to a lot of the hotels. It depends on which ones you're going to, but a lot of the hotels are pretty vacant. And the ones that are open, there are a lot of safety issues that need to be done. It's better than it was back in March and April. And, of course, in New York City and New Jersey and pretty much all over the states, they are opening up 25% of the indoor restaurants at this point. But overall, it's a slow process, and it's one that eventually I believe will get back to normal. But it will take a year or so for that to happen.
Now, my biggest concern, since you mentioned air travel, my biggest concern is the relative, shall we say, ease or lack of actual rules that are involved when it comes to air travel. I'll give you a story that I know from personal experience from somebody I know. They traveled from Toronto to Winnipeg on an open-ended ticket, so no return ticket. In some cases, you have to quarantine 2 weeks when you reach the destination where you're going. No one asked about that 2 week quarantine when he arrived. No one asked how long he had stayed when he was leaving. And to me, that's just the opportunity for someone to be a super spreader.
I thoroughly agree with you on that. I mean, here in the United States, we have a certain amount of states that if you're coming from, depending on hotspots, if you're coming into, let's say, New York City, for example, where I live, you have to basically quarantine for 2 weeks. That's a situation that's being watched, especially at the airports. To hear that happen, it does give me chills, because if you can do that, unfortunately, this is a virus that spreads very quickly. And of course, something like that, especially on an airline coming in from an airport, I can see coming in by car if you're just going, from one district to another, where you can probably get away with that. But when you're talking about an airline and an airport, where you have to go through, different things in order to get through the airport security, I find that hard to believe that they're not going to check that. So I'm not sure if that's an issue. I've not known that to be an issue in the United States. At least I've never heard about that. But unfortunately, that's not a very good situation. And in Canada, I know, has done a very good job, much better than the United States, when it comes to, stopping this virus from spreading to the point where it is here in the States. So that's bad news. I'm sorry to hear that.
And again, let me reiterate, the rules are there. They're definitely there. The surprise was on the person who felt that they weren't necessarily asked enough questions about where they were coming from, how long they were staying while they were being questioned. That's the concern this person had, that they didn't feel there was enough of an investigation as to his travel plans. That's what his concern was. So in other words,
It's good that you're bringing that up because of the fact that maybe it wasn't publicized enough as it should be. And actually talking about it is a very good thing for people that maybe don't know about that for whatever reason.
So considering the world we all live in right now, do you have any recommendations as to, because, you know, a lot of people are having cabin fever and they want to go somewhere. What do you recommend for some people who are a bit skittish about the idea of traveling at this time, but still want to go somewhere? What do you recommend?
Well, right now, I always recommend that, first of all, if it's my 6-hour rule, if you have to travel someplace that takes longer than 6 hours in a car, then I would suggest to fly at that point. But if it's 5 to 6 hours in a car, you're in a situation where you can actually, you know, you have a little more control of the situation of what you're doing. I highly recommend people actually will drive to a location. The most important factor right now is always plan ahead. Plan where you're going to stop. Plan where you're going to eat. You have that whole thing all set up. Now, the good part is you can go outside, and because of the ultraviolet rays and the distancing that's easier to do, it's okay to go to parks. It's okay to do things as long as you maintain that 6 feet have your own bubble and keep 6 feet away from other people. That can be easily achieved at a park or outside to do stuff. So it doesn't mean you can't go out and have some fun. It just means that you need to be a little more cautious. And, of course, wear masks. Because the mask not only helps you, it really, really does help the other individuals or the people that are around you, so that basically everything is contained on both ends. So I would say continue doing what you're doing, especially if you're outside. The issue occurs when you have to go inside. And unfortunately, even though the airplane has a good ventilation system, the problem is that you're kind of close to the next person, even though maybe the middle seat is not taking. You want to make sure that you have distance there. So just still travel. Outside is better than inside at this point until we have that vaccine.
And very quickly, because we have just about a minute, in doing your research, are there any locations that you've come across that seem to be doing it well, that are welcoming, but are also at the same time following rules and regulations and are cautious in bringing in tourists?
Well, again, I would say that the best areas to go right now are parks. It doesn't have to be an amusement park. It could be an actual national park or any type of a park system. They're doing it extremely well because of the fact that they don't have as many people. When they do have, they have distance because you're outside 95% of the time and are able to do a better job. So I would say parks. Even amusement parks are doing quite well at this point because of the fact that they're limited to the amount of people that can go in, and it's that. Unfortunately, the people that are not doing well, or the places that are not doing well, are self-contained stadiums and inside restaurants. Here in the United States, we are doing the outside restaurant system. We're just getting back into the inside ones, but unfortunately, it's better to be outside. Again, because of the distancing and because of the ultraviolet light from the sun, and from just feeling a little more safer that way. So movie theaters are going to probably get hit the worst wherever you are, because that's self-contained, not cleaned as often, because it's just hard to do that. And that, I worry about the outside movie cinema industry at this point. That's going to be one that's going to have a hard time bouncing back. Right now,
I remember it was just a year ago that we were talking about a brand new mall and theme park that was in your neck of the woods in New Jersey. I would assume they're having tough times right now.
Malls are open in New Jersey, and the American Dream is open at this time, and it is the world's largest, park. Actually, in this case, the mall. But unfortunately, mall hours are very short. A lot of the inside roller coasters and thrill rides that were there are closed. Unfortunately, it's just not going to be on that level. Again, malls are open, but they are very, very security-wise. A lot of people, including my wife, who loves to shop, are avoiding those inside malls at this point. It's coming back, but again, on a very, very, very slow basis.
Well, hopefully we'll get out of 2020 soon enough and things will look better when 2021 rolls around and people can get out and about and travel once again. Thank you very much, Pete, for being on the program with us. Always a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye.
Pete Trabuco, author of A Personal Guide to the Best Amusement Parks and Water Parks. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0581, and you'll find links to Pete's site, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
Got something for the mailbag? Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. Send your email to mailbag@thestufffile.com. And remember, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H. That's mailbag@thestufffile.com. Or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Often I mention my book, Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. I also often mention that I'd like you to become a patron of the Stuff File program via Patreon.com. Well, this is my opportunity to combine both of those pleas to you. You've heard me say on many occasions about the myriad of celebrities I've had the chance to talk to that are contained in my book, which is published by Bear Manor Media. You've also heard me mention that some of the celebrities in my book, and many others, can be heard on our page at Patreon.com. Well, if you've been on the fence about joining Patreon, let me try to pull you over to our side. By becoming a patron, you help to make this show an even bigger and better radio experience. And if you do become a regular patron, as a Patreon reward, I'll share with you an electronic version of my book for your e-reader. So join Patreon and claim your copy of Great Conversations, My Interviews with Two Men on the Moon and a Galaxy of Stars. Sign up today at patreon.com/thestufffileprogram.
From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Now, the Stuff File presents Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy. It's radio that's out of this world.
Andrew, there are two items to talk about. One is finding gas on Venus, but first, Andrew, we all have a bone to pick with you. Yeah, we do. There was an asteroid the size of a football field that just missed Earth, and we got no warning. Now, usually you tell us about these things. How did this pass us by?
And you know, the funny thing is, it's not just that it, it's just not me. It's even the professional astronomers, you know, they're just not able to pick out small asteroids. And so when we're talking about here that came by, you know, in the last week of September, this is one of many that now we're starting to understand that there's many every year that do make a close buzz by our planet. Now, this particular one came even closer than most communication satellites that orbit Earth. Now, thankfully, the size that this one is, and there was another one that came even closer back in August. You may remember the media buzz around that one. That came even closer. That was a close graze. It only came about within 3,000 kilometers of the surface of the Earth. This one was more like about, you know, 28,000 kilometers from the surface of the Earth. But both of these, if they would have entered the atmosphere, thankfully, they would have broken up. So even if we were right in the crosshairs of these giant rocks, we would be safe because they would have just disintegrated because they were impacting they would have impacted the atmosphere at very high speeds. So that at least, but we cannot see them, Peter. This is something that's, you know, it's a bit worrisome for astronomers because they're just so small. They're too small for our even our giant telescopes to pick them out until they're practically on us. They're you know, going to fly past Earth, or even in, like the one in August, they only found out after it made its close approach to Earth. So about 6 hours after it buzzed by our planet is when they discovered its existence. And that's because of their small size.
Well, it is worrisome because, you know, you are a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. We depend on you. We depend
on you.
The
only thing I could say is that having seen the size of these, they're not really of any concern to. They don't pose a threat to Earth or humanity because of their really tiny little size. They're really no match for our planet. So we could, you know, that's probably why I kind of looked to the side and kind of didn't want to worry people. And that's something that I do. I don't want people to be worried. These things happen a lot, but they're interesting to note. And I think, Peter, what it does is it kind of, I think it should bring people's attention to, hey, there are astronomers, teams of astronomers that are searching for asteroids, near-Earth asteroids, ones that come close to Earth or have the potential to impact Earth. And I think we need to be aware that these surveys need to be funded. We need to make sure that we support these efforts of surveying and being able to detect these potentially hazardous asteroids.
Mm. Now, you mentioned the distance that they came or the closeness that they had to Earth. How far does something have to be before it's affected by our gravitational pull?
Well, that's a good question. They have to come fairly close to us. So within a few thousand kilometers from the surface of the Earth for them to really be affected deeply, especially the smaller sized ones, the ones that we can't detect until they were almost on us. So the one that we saw this week, the one that we saw, the end of September and the one end of August, both of these asteroids actually changed their trajectory, the path that they're following in space, because of the pull of Earth. Because they came so close to our planet, we actually managed to change the pathway that they're following in space forever. So it's only a few thousand kilometers that they need to be within.
And which direction were they going? Were they going toward the sun or away from the sun?
Well, and that's a really interesting point too. Part of the reason why we're not able to find these near-Earth asteroids many times, as was the case here, that they are too small. That's for sure. But the other reason is that sometimes, like in these two occasions in August and September, the asteroids appear to be coming from in the direction from the sun, from our vantage point. So when they're coming in sort of in the area of the sky where the sun is, of course, we're blinded by the sunlight. And so we cannot see an asteroid or any object coming from that direction. And that was the case with these two. So that is a factor also in our inability to catch these things until they're almost upon us.
Okay, so they're coming from the direction of the sun, which means they're coming by us by way of Venus, which brings us to our next topic. And that is the fact that there's some curious questions about possible life on Venus because of a certain gas that was found. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this gas that they're talking about, they're all excited about, is called phosphine. Now, here on our planet, this is a very smelly, toxic gas. It's basically the atom phosphorus with three oxygen atoms next to it. So this phosphine likes to exist here on Earth naturally. They're made by microbes, and they thrive in very oxygen-free environments. That's a byproduct of life, microbial life, in very inhospitable areas like the deepest, darkest oceans. The only other way to make phosphine is industrially. So we humans make it. It's a byproduct of our chemical industry.
What do we make it for?
That I'm not sure of.
Okay.
It's particularly, I think the phosphine is sort of a byproduct of certain kind of drug compounds that are being made in factories. So, but in nature, microbes make it. So these are the only two ways that we know. It's industrially phosphine's made or by microbes. And scientists say this gas that they found, phosphine, that exists in the atmosphere of Venus shouldn't even be there because the natural environment of Venus, according to what we see, cannot make the amounts of phosphine that we've seen. And they basically looked at different possible non-biological processes that could have made this gas. So they looked at sunlight, perhaps, making sunlight hitting the atmosphere, molecules in the atmosphere of Venus. Could that have changed and created phosphine? Could have minerals blown up from the surface, or maybe volcanoes on Venus that spew out this gas, or perhaps a side effect from lightning, which we know exists in the atmosphere of Venus. But none of these non-biological processes could make anywhere near enough of this phosphine. In fact, they says these non-biological sources like lightning and volcano, if you even add them all up, they were found to make at most 1/10,000th the amount of phosphine that they discovered with their telescopes.
And before answering the question of how could this possibly happen, which you say the scientists are trying to figure out, how are they absolutely certain that what they have discovered is phosphine?
Well, it has a very distinctive chemical fingerprint. So when they're using radio telescopes, basically to penetrate the atmosphere, the outer cloud layer of Venus, they're able to basically receive a signal back with their radio telescope, bouncing back, and they have distinctive radio signatures of phosphine. It's like a fingerprint, but in a chemical way, and that is definitely that substance, phosphine, and it's in a significant amount. That's the other thing. It's the amount that they're seeing that cannot be explained non-biologically from at least what we see in the science that we understand it.
Now, is this something that is a precursor to life or the end result of life? In other words, where is Venus in the life spectrum kind of thing? You know what I mean?
Right. So if we want to place that, and that is this a pre-life compound, or is it something of a byproduct? It's a byproduct. It's not a pre-life. It's something that life forms would make. And we're talking about microbes. So we're not talking about little green men, any advanced life form. This would be microbes. This is the theory that's going on. They're not saying that they have found life, but they sure can't explain this any other way. It would make the most sense. So, you know, Peter, you'd have to look at it this way. There's two possibilities. One is that we've discovered some kind of new chemical reaction, that chemistry or physical process on Venus that we've never seen on any Earth-like planet before. So that means that we have to rethink our understanding of the basic chemistry of Earth-like planets, because you have to remember, Venus is almost exactly the same size of Earth as Earth, and we have the same history. We were born from the same cloud 4.5 billion years ago around the sun, and so we have the same basic chemical makeup, both our planets. And if it's non-biological, it means that there's some new science happening, which is super exciting. The alternative is that this is a byproduct of current life, very possibly microbial life, very small, microscopic life forms that are floating in the upper atmosphere of Venus in large clouds and being pushed around by the winds. That is the other possibility.
So what you're saying is Earth and Venus are like twins in the same way that Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito are twins.
In a sense, yeah, well, they've both taken their own paths, exactly.
Okay. Always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you very much once again for explaining this, and we may let you off about the whole situation with the asteroids missing us, but thanks once again, sir.
You're most welcome. Clear skies.
Andrew Fazekas, the night sky guy, and the author of National Geographic's Backyard Guide to the Night Sky. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com, and you can go to my website at thestufffile.com. Check out the show number for this program, which is show number 0581, and you'll find links to his site and also links to either amazon.com or amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. It's time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
24-year-old convicted drug smuggler Mike Guilin hired a helicopter at an airport near Antwerp, Belgium on September 25th, then hijacked the aircraft in mid-flight and forced the pilot to fly to Berkendaal Women's Prison south of Brussels to free his 27-year-old wife, Christel Appelt, who is being held there on suspicion of murdering her ex-boyfriend. As inmates cheered and waved below, the pilot circled the prison yard, trying unsuccessfully to land, while Guilin put his head out of the chopper to vomit 5 times before giving up and flying off. Authorities arrested Guilin and several accomplices within 24 hours when they discovered he had used his real name to hire the chopper. Said Guilin's attorney, "It seems the whole thing has been staged quite amateurishly." You figure? I mean, why? Oh, why? Would you book a helicopter under your own name, hijack it in mid-flight to bust your wife out of prison, when clearly you not only haven't thought this through, but didn't bother to check that you'd probably get airsick not once, not twice, but 5 times? One reason, and one reason only. You're an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0581. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0581. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check us out on patreon.com, where you can become a patron of the program. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, Verdant Square Radio, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, PCJ Radio International and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on Apple or Google Podcasts, streaming on Spotify, Stitcher, and iHeartRadio, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
Been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. The Stuff File reminds you never try to drown your sorrows. They'll just learn to swim anyway.